Tēnā koutou, welcome to season 5 of the New Zealand Society of Authors Oral History Podcast. I'm Karen Hay. I'm glad you can join us. Witi Ihimaera has become one of Aotearoa New Zealand's most recognised and decorated writers over his 50-plus years as an author. The first episode of this season covered some of those highlights, and if you haven't listened to it, go back and find it. It's rewarding listening. However, today we're going to start way back when Witi talks to Deborah Shepherd about being a young boy writing stories on the walls.
I was writing fiction, I was writing stories, and it still staggers me to realise that some of those stories that I wrote when I was between, say, 7 and 11 are still the basis of my work. And every now and then, you know, I will say to myself, oh my God, so that's where this came from. You know, like I've just finished writing a play, and so that play's been performed in Wellington. And my grandmother took me down to Peel Street when my sisters and I, we used to have fish and chips down there, and there's a monument down there to Weepere. And that was where she told me the story of how he farewelled the soldiers to First World War in 1915, Māori soldiers. So that when I actually came to writing the play, which is called All Our Sons, I didn't realise I've been writing this thing all my life. I mean, ever since my grandmother told me that story and I put it on my bedroom wall, it's been there. All these stories have just been waiting for the moment when I can do them. And for the moment when they have the best chance of survival and the best chance of making an impact. Because sometimes it's not just writing the story itself that's important, it's when they come out. So that in 2013, I was writing Māori Boy, and I've said this somewhere else. In the middle of Māori Boy, I suddenly realised, my God, it's the 100th commemoration of the First World War. Mm-hmm. And nobody is writing, I was so arrogant, nobody is writing anything about the first Native contingent or about the Pioneer Battalion. So I'm going to write this as a novel.
Right.
So it was a novel called All Our Sons. I went to Harriet straight away. I said, I'm going to put down the memoir, and I'm going to write this novel about the First World War. And she blanched and she said, but Witi, you know, of course, that by the time we publish this, the First World War will be over, so you will have lost your opportunity. And she was right. So I then went to Robin Scholes. I then wrote it as a film script, thinking, well, then, you know, we could make it as a film, mm-hmm. because it's important that New Zealanders know about this. And this is an Indigenous history of the First World War. It's not just a Māori mm-hmm. history, it's an mm-hmm. Aboriginal history. It's a history of the Kanak people and their war in La Grande Guerre. It's a history of the First Nations people of Canada who went to the war. I mean, you know, as I said, it's all spontaneous combustion. Mm-hmm. So I wrote it. I think I must have written it in around about 2 weeks.
Wow.
And took it to her and said, Robin, I've written a film script about the First World War. And she said, love the idea, think it's going to be great, but it's going to take us 12 years to raise the money. So I then rewrote it, and all of these versions are in my archives now, as a stadium event, thinking that if I want to make a hit of this, I really have to see if my friends from C Company in Gisborne will help me with an army involvement. And then I've got some nephews who are involved in kapahaka, so I could make this into a kapahaka event. And then couldn't find anybody. Then I'd actually put bits of it on in the ANZ Festival in 2013, and Paula Morris had been part of that, and also who's the young writer who's a columnist who's now turned himself into a non-fiction writer, writes wonderful essays. Very well known, can't remember. I called him into playing one of the roles, and so he did, and then the Kapahaka group at London House came on, and so we did it. So I thought, yes, it can work. And then I also did it in Taiwan and realised it can work. Mm-hmm. And these Taiwanese historians were coming up to me and saying, you know, this is exactly our story, except, of course, we weren't fighting against the Turks, we were fighting against the Japanese. But we still faced the same sort of thing as indigenous soldiers who weren't recognised. So when I came back, I had a meeting with Tainui Tuki Waho and said, would Takirua be interested? So this was my fourth try.
Gosh.
In 2013-2014. And this was in February 2014. And he said, well, can you send it to me? And so I sent it to him and he said, there's another aspect, and that is that I was at New Year at Piha with Jenny Gibbs at Jenny's house. And my friend Carolyn Henwood was there from the Circa Theatre. She said that they were looking for a stage production to put on in 2015. So I told her about this, and she said, oh, it's about First World War. We're not doing anything about the First World War, are we, Ray? Because, you know, her husband, Ray Henwood, was there. And he said, no, I don't think so. And so she said, oh, well, I'll get some money together, and I'll see if we can put something on. So she got some money. Takirua got some money. We then put it on as a kind of reduced stadium event.
Mm-hmm.
For 2015, so it's just been on.
You're just back from that.
And now I'm in the business of trying to recreate it as for a marae tour, a city tour, an overseas tour. Because as a writer, I think there's one difference between myself and many other writers, and that is that I'm good at negotiating and I'm good at being a producer of stuff.
So, and across instance, such a range of genres,
yeah,
too.
I was associate producer for Whale Rider. I'm the associate producer for Mahana. I'm a producer of my own theatrical work. So those sorts of skills I can bring when it comes to actually putting things up and negotiating contracts and getting my work to publication.
Mm. Then to go back to writing your first story. You did write a first story at school, didn't you?
Yes.
What was that called? The Prodigal Daughter?
The Prodigal Daughter.
About your sister?
Yes, for Mr. Groner. He asked me to do a short story for 6B2 for the sixth form literary competition.
This was 1962.
Yeah. Yes, and so I wrote that, and its structure is interesting, just thinking about it, because clearly I was modelling it on The Prodigal Son with that title, except that I called it The Prodigal Daughter. And throughout my career, I've made it part of my whole methodology to try to find a way in which Māori story can be told, not just for its own sake, but through the lens of some Pākehā template, which adds to its resonances and therefore also gives a Pākehā audience the opportunity to make assumptions that it is similar to, in other words, they can then call upon their own hinterland of literary mythology and ethnology and creativity to bring to it this, what I also bring to it.
Yes,
and that way, it's a kind of creation of what I call a different sort of literature for New Zealand.
Mm.
So most of my work, that first short story, I think, is probably where I may have begun to think of my work existing within, say, you know, these other templates other than Māori, so that I could shift the Māori content into a recognisable European framework and then begin to subvert that framework.
Yes.
But there was one before then. The one before then was something that I'd written in primary school about a princess, and that's the one about the...
Tell that story.
A princess who locked in a tall tower guarded by a fierce dragon, and every day she would run to the window and see a handsome prince ride by on a white horse, and she would yell, help me, help me. Save me from this dragon. But because she was so ugly, the princes on their white horses would keep on riding further down the road to rescue a more beautiful princess. Day after day this happened until she got so sick and tired of waiting that she went out and married the dragon. So again, it's, you know, I'm looking at a fairy tale in that story and thinking, So what can I do to make it different? Yeah. And then because I'm a very mischievous writer,
yes,
and I sometimes get myself irritated by what I see, I wrote that one. And it wasn't until later that that I grew up and was a writer that I was at a conference and a man came up to me and said, you know, this is a very, very clever story. And I said, well, what's clever about it? And he said, well, because the princess is not beautiful like princesses are supposed to be. And she embraces danger when she marries the dragon and she leaves the land of safety. All of this sort of stuff he was saying to me. Yeah, I think up to that point there'd been enough going on in my brain from all of the influences that I was getting for it to suddenly say, all right, witty, so now you've reached this age, so this is where you could go. And then, so that was at 9. And then at 18, when I wrote this story for Mr. Grono, so witty, you know, now you've got some more understanding. So this is the way it's appearing.
Your first story was The Liar, which was published in The Listener. What was that about?
Yeah, well, that was an appropriate title to give piece of work.
Yeah.
Because in many ways, you know, fiction is all about about lying your way through life. And the thing that my mother was really, really worried about, just to get back to your analysis, is that there she was making sure that everything was what we call ticker.
Yes.
That is perfect and real and
truthful.
Everything was truthful, you know. So this person, that was his mother and that was his father and that's where they come from.
Mm.
And then here was I looking at people in my life and then pushing it over into fiction, which they could never understand in those days. They never understood what fiction was, and I really mean that. My grandmother, Minnie, I told her I was writing, and I was writing about Waituhi, and she said, oh, are you? And she said, oh, yeah, all right, so what are you going to write about? And I said, I'm going to be writing about you. And she said, oh, you're going to write about me? Oh, that's good. And she said, so you're going to write about Waituhi? And I said, yes, I told you I'm going to write about Waituhi, but I'm not going to call it Waituhi, I'm going to call it something else. And she said, why do you want to do that? Are you ashamed of us? And I said, no, but I'm not really writing about the real Waituhi. And she said, well, what sort of Waituhi are you going to write about? And I said, well, it's kind of like Waituhi, but it isn't Waituhi. And I'm not going to call you Minnie. And she said, what are you going to call me? And I'm going to call you Miro, I said. And she said, but my name's not Miro. So I honestly didn't understand why it was going to be a problem. I honestly didn't. Until it came out. And then when it came out, I realized everything they look at, they think the written word, because Māori, they never read fiction.
Yeah.
They read comics, but the comics were illustrated comics.
Yes, something else.
They read
they?
The Bible,
yes.
Where the Bible was the word of
word,
God.
Yes.
You know? And so here was I coming along, writing all of these things, and sometimes getting things wrong on purpose, sometimes, and not right, getting it wrong on purpose, sometimes a lot of things that needed to be corrected. But most of all, I was using the people in Waituhi. When they all started to read the book and they'd laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh, and they'd say, oh, that's you, Minnie, you know, and that's Mrs. Waitaiki, and that's old man Te Ua, and all of this. But then it wasn't them. And because clearly when you're writing something, you also have to develop a critical, objective faculty. Because sometimes I would, in that first book, I was writing about the Makutu on Mrs. Jones, so Makutu. I was writing about a man who was chopping his way through the door to get at the food because his tribe wasn't feeding.
We're talking about Purnamu.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I was hurting them as much as I was helping them and supporting them. And then when I wrote whānau and tangi. My mother said, as long as you write tangi before you come home, because, you know, and before your father dies, because as long as you do that, then we all can all just say it's just your usual pretend. And she wasn't saying that at all in a positive way. It was, do this before your father dies, because then everybody will say, oh, that's not Tom. So then you can write anything you like about your father. You can write anything you like about me, because it's not about us. And it was a hard lesson to learn, because there's a letter, I still have to find it. I went over to see David Heap. He said that the archives for Penguin and Heinemann books are pretty awful, and that there was a lot of stuff thrown out in the 1990s or so. But I did write him a letter, and I'm trying to find a copy of it in my own archives, saying, if my father dies before Tangi comes out, then we are not to publish it.
Right.
Because once it comes out and he dies, then people will immediately see it as being non-fiction and truth.
I'm Karen Hay, and this is the New Zealand Society of Authors Oral History Podcast. We'll be back to the podcast in a moment, but we want to remind you that the NZSA is the professional representative body which lobbies for the rights of all authors in New Zealand. NZSA will be representing writers in the ongoing reviews of the 2019 Copyright Act and campaigning for a stronger public lending right. NZSA collaborates across the sector to raise the visibility and discoverability of local books and local writers. To learn more about these important issues and to find out how to become a member, visit authors.org.nz. Best known as an author who broke ground for Māori writers, Weti Ihimara also broke new ground in Aotearoa New Zealand when his 1995 novel, Nights in the Garden of Spain, was published, about the coming out of a married man. As he explains to Deborah Shepherd, it was a book with very personal roots for Weti.
Well, I began a relationship with Murray Shaw during a Springbok tour. And at the same time, I was also the Victoria University of Wellington's fellow for that year. So it was something that I wasn't expecting to happen. And yet when you think about the context of it all during the Springbok tour, and possibly my need to find someone beyond my relationship with Jane and the children and the family, because when you enter into a different relationship, it's not just because of one's sexual nature, it's also because one is wanting something else. Maybe it's the whole nature of being an artist or whatever. I'm not going to blame that, but there was something in me that needed something else. And that relationship was wonderful. I mean, we began this relationship then, it must have been 1984, and we didn't close it until 1994 or 1995. So that's a really long, long time. So I've had the good fortune to have had long relationships in my life. We went to New York together. I then became involved, and the way in which I grabbed things out of the universe and around me, I then began to understand about the nature of being within the gay minority. And back in New Zealand, the equivalent of the gay minority was the Māori minority. 10% of the population was considered to be Māori, 10% of the population was considered to be gay. The same issues of sovereignty, of identity, of a search for space to be able to to live an honest life, a just life. So I then asked Murray when I was approaching the year 1990, which was also the 150th anniversary of the Treaty of Waitangi. Mm-hmm. So all of those things were happening within, this was the urtext to what was happening.
Okay.
I began in that year, well, I didn't actually begin it in that year, I actually began it much earlier than that, a novel called A Walk in the Sun. And it was a novel that was set during the Springbok tour. And it was about two young men who meet. And one was going to be Māori and the other one was going to be European. I put that one aside because the emotional intensity of it was too huge to even contemplate. But also I then realised that the difference between Nights in the Gardens of Spain and other fiction with gay content is that I had not read any other book which was about a man who was married and coming out. Most gay fiction was based on a man who was gay but single, and
right.
therefore it was about him trying to find his identity within a gay community. But with mine, I thought that that was its value, that
yes.
although it might talk to the gay community, it might even do a better job by talking to a heterosexual community as well as a gay community in which married men were finding it difficult and married women were finding it difficult to face the issues of gayness within a family. I have to say that as a writer, there was also huge advantage in creating the tension and the dynamic between a married man who falls in love with a single man, as Murray was. So there were all of these things happening in my mind. So Murray didn't want it to happen, because although I was more than happy to out myself, the situation with outing is that you don't only out yourself, you out your partner,
yes.
you out your family, you out your wider whānau
yeah.
as well. But I had also become involved in gay politics back here in New Zealand, and I was the first gay, president or chairman of the first Auckland-based gay group for Māori and Pacific Island students, Māori and Pacific Island gay men. And our function, I felt, went beyond what the AIDS Foundation's function was. The AIDS Foundation said that they were there to educate gay men about unsafe sex practices, but they didn't help gay men who had AIDS. So our group was formed, and we were fortunate that we were able to have a collaboration with what was known as the Isherwood Trust, was to help those men who actually did have AIDS and who needed to therefore have the kind of support to be able to go back to their families and then to negotiate acceptance for them. So I began this group with a small group of others, and we were very, very successful in establishing ourselves for something. But it radicalised me much in the same way as Māori protest during the 1980s had radicalised me. So when Murray said that he didn't want it to happen, I did put it away. However, we were also, he and I, going through a period of great stress. And so in the end, when I felt that we were hitting a wall with our relationship, I said to him, well, I'm going to do this anyway. And I think that that really was the nail in that relationship. And I should have realised it, but, you know, I mean, there's that saying that you, sometimes you do these things and you lose the whole world. So I wrote the book. I then negotiated with Penguin, because I had also written Bully Basha, King of the Gypsies. As I say, I write very fast. So then they said, well, what they would do is to bring out, which one came first now, I can't remember.
Bully Basha came first in 94.
They said, And they would bring out Bully Basho in 1994, and then the next year they'd bring out Nights in the Gardens of Spain, which was actually written. So they wanted to bring those two books out so that I would still maintain my audience, but at the same time signal, you know, a personal change as well as a professional one. Before it came out, even though Murray didn't want it to come out, I then also had to ask the kids.
Yes. What age were they at that point, the children?
Well, they were still... Jessica was at high school and Olivia was at the end of intermediate.
Right.
Or around about that stage. So Jessica, my brave Jessica, said to me, you know, Daddy, we know that you want to publish it and we know that you will publish it, but could you wait for a couple of years? Because by then Olivia will have left intermediate and she'll be at high school where there'll be more understanding for her, and I'll be at university. The idea of publishing after Bully Basho kind of fitted in with all of that as well. Even so, there were times when it was pretty awful for us all. I had rocks thrown through my window. In those days, before you had caller ID on phones, I had anonymous telephone calls. I had anonymous letters.
What did the reviewers do with it?
The reviews were actually very, very good. And because I had made the characters both European rather than one Māori, one European, then it seemed like it was a story that of an everyman rather than... Because there is a difference. Once you bring race into a situation, then it changes the text.
Of course.
And I didn't really want this to happen that way. I didn't want it to be a story where race did not... preclude the opportunity for people to read themselves into these two characters. So I think it was a triumphant sense of public relations bringing out that book. And while I might have lost some readers, I think I also gained a lot of readers. But I also discovered new ways of writing. So I always looked to that book as being the one which derailed my usual approach to sentence and to the micro level, because I wasn't thinking about Māori story and thinking of European story. It allowed me to do things there that I would probably not have been able to if I had maintained a Māori approach.
In what other ways did it free up the writing? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Not necessarily free up, but it made me think of an evolving way of creating character. Up until that time, I never thought that I was very good at creating character. So in Nights in the Gardens of Spain, with because in Māori there is no such thing as character.
Okay, but your children, and the wife, very strong characters.
Yes. So,
personalities.
The kind of cultural constraints were off. The kind of literary forms that I was trying to deploy in my Māori fiction of Waiata, of haka, of kōrero, the more ritualistic approach to structure, they weren't there. And so I was going with I guess pure storytelling in Nights in the Gardens of Spain. I was able to become a little bit more musical in intonation and a little bit more...
There's tenderness.
Longer. There's a lot of tenderness, but there's also a lot of ugliness too.
Yes.
And so it helped me to just be able to breathe a little bit more wider and deeper. It's probably my most artistic book.
I can see that.
It's Nights in the Gardens of Spain.
Did you enjoy writing the erotic? Because that's another whole genre in itself, isn't it?
I had a lot of laughs writing the erotic because I like to have one or two things happening at the same time. And so as much as the erotic is there, there's also something else there as well. So I had a lot of joy, I think I can say, in trying to express a deeper level of sexuality that I would never have been able to do in Māoridom. And the equivalent to Nights in the Gardens of Spain, but from a Māori approach, is the other book that I wrote, which is on a gay theme, and that's The Uncle's Story, yes. where the sexuality is not as free and it's not as erotic, but certainly is darker and more savage. Oh, one other thing about Nights in the Gardens of Spain, there is this saying, who's it by? That if you look long into the abyss looks long into you. And I think that that book is the one that that the abyss looked long into me.
Yeah. How did your family deal with it? Did your mother ever read it?
My mother thought I was going to go straight to hell.
Yeah.
And because she was a Mormon and she was religious, my sister told me. And I said to her, well, you know, this is I expected this from Mum. But my mother never really talked to me about it at all. So I know that she managed in her own way to reconcile what I had done in my personal life and the fact that I wasn't keeping it a secret. But I think she understood that because she herself knew what secrets mean.
Your father?
My father, I can remember he came to see me afterwards. We were living in Wellington. He came down on a wool board meeting, and so he wanted to stay with us, and normally with me and Murray, and normally with my dad, what we would do is that we would sleep in the same room, sometimes in the same bed, so that he could tell me what was happening with the farm and with the relatives, and just bring me up to date on Waitahi. So he was somewhat surprised when I said to him, well, Dad, I can't come and stay with you, can't be in the bedroom with you because I'm in this bed with Murray. And so at that stage, Murray kind of decided it was time for him to exit. And so my father and I talked about what had happened. My father always was a person who always wanted to believe in the best. And he was very, very good at erasing from his mind what he didn't like. So as long as I didn't push him, he was fine.
Jane, how did Jane feel about Nights in the Gardens of Spain?
Well, Jane has always been similar to me in the sense that she can objectivise things as well as be very subjective about them. And she was very, very proud. She thought that it was, you know, just a beautifully written book. Murray didn't read it until a long time after we'd separated. And then when he read it, he then sent me a letter and said that he felt that it was my best work. It was really, I knew it had taken him a long time to even think about reading it. And I think that he had fears that I would treat him shabbily or badly in it, but I didn't.
You've been listening to the second episode of Season 5 of the New Zealand Society of Authors Oral History Podcast. This episode featured audio for the oral history interview between Huiti Ihemaira and Deborah Shepherd, recorded in 2015. You can find episodes from past seasons and be notified when the next episode is available by subscribing to the podcast on SoundCloud or wherever you listen. This podcast was produced by Elizabeth Kirkby-McLeod for the New Zealand Society of Authors, with audio support from Yana Tanahu Owen. Notturno by Ottorino Respigi, which you're listening to now, is performed by Justin Bird. I'm Karen Hay, and this was a New Zealand Society of Authors Oral History Podcast. Ka kite anō, o ia koutou.